the news tonight, IS is using human shields in the U.S.-backed war in Iraq to retake the city of Mosul,
forcing people to move to sites where their fighters are based.
Code Pink's Medea Benjamin says the U.S.-backed Saudi war in Yemen is bringing hardship to untold millions.
Why is the U.S. participating in this Saudi-led bombing campaign that started 19 months ago?
WBAI's Earth Mum is in North Dakota with the Water Protectors.
We're on treaty territory, and we are right on the land where Dakota Access Pipeline is planned to go through.
Women call out candidates to declare whether they are for or against Donald Trump.
And we will vote down all the down-ballot candidates who continue to stand with him.
And the Brennan Center for Justice debunks Trump's claims over rigging the nation's election. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Wednesday, October 26, 2016. Beginning with international news, as fighting in Iraq to drive Daesh, or IS, from the city of Mosul continues, reports are that IS is using civilians as human shields. This is according to UN Human Rights. It says people are being forced to move to areas where IS fighters are located. Mosul has been under IS control since 2014. The U.S.-backed Iraqi government launched an offensive last week to free the city. It is located in the north of the country with a pre-war population of around 2 million. It's at least five times the size of any other city IS has controlled. Daniel Johnson spoke with UN Human Rights spokesperson Rupert Colville.
You've had one particularly disturbing report, if you wouldn't mind giving us more details.
Yeah, particularly disturbing incident, which I think illustrates both ISIL forcing villagers to leave, presumably for human shield reasons, and also their sheer barbarity. It happened last Saturday when they shot dead three women and three young girls, three children, and wounded a further four children. And that was when they were forcing the villagers to leave a village called Rafaela, which is to the south of Mosul City. The victims were shot apparently because they were lagging behind. They were about 100 meters behind the rest of the villagers who were being forced to leave the village. And the reason they were lagging behind was because one of the children, one of the little girls, was disabled. And she was apparently among those who were shot dead. So it's, you know, this kind of appalling ruthlessness one sees with ISIL. You shoot a disabled child, you shoot other girl children and their mothers for no good reason at all.
Do you have any information on what's happening inside Mosul itself?
We have very little information from inside Mosul, or at least information that we can anyway verify at this point. But a certain amount of information is coming out from the surrounding areas, partly through people who are fleeing, managing to escape, and partly through people who are still managing very bravely to make phone calls out of the areas where they are trapped inside ISIL-controlled territory.
And you also have concerns about what's been happening in Kirkuk, elsewhere in Iraq, with the surprise attack by ISIL.
We're a bit concerned about reports from Kirkuk following the sort of major surprise attack by ISIL there last Friday, when they killed a lot of people and made a big assault in the city. In response to that, apparently, the local authorities, the security committee of the Kirkuk governorate, decided to order all the internally displaced people who'd come from other areas, mostly ISIL-controlled areas, to leave the city unless they were already living in camps. So these are the people who are living sort of by themselves or living with hosts inside the city. One can understand the kind of security fears the authorities have, but this is hugely problematic for the displaced people themselves, not least because there was really no kind of preparation for it. And because all the camps in the embassy full, either completely full already or very close to full. So we're very concerned that this kind of really random clearing out of individuals and families living in Kirkuk City could add massively to the displacement problem that the region already has, and which, of course, could get much worse if large numbers of people manage to escape from Mosul.
The UN's Daniel Johnson spoke with Rupert Colville with UN Human Rights. Since the operation to recapture Mosul from Daesh began last week, the U.S. military has dropped 1,700 munitions on targets in the battlefield. Meanwhile, IS has typically laid out hundreds of landmines and booby traps designed to kill civilians before retreating from towns and cities across areas in Iraq. According to Human Rights Watch, IS has executed hundreds of civilians, forced women into sexual slavery, used child soldiers, and prevented civilians from leaving conflict zones. And while the goal is saving human lives in Iraq and in Syria from IS, there is disagreement over the methods being used. Disagreements over sending arms and committing U.S. forces to battle to save Mosul and whether this will just open the door to continued bloodletting, retribution, or greater extremism. Another hotspot is Yemen. That's where Houthis, which practice a religion close to Shia, has been rising up. And the Saudis, which are primarily Sunni, are worried that Shia Iran would come in and that they would be facing a Shia-controlled government in Yemen on the Saudi border. 2 million people have been displaced in Yemen. The majority of the population is going without clean drinking water or a functioning sewage system, with a recent outbreak of cholera due to the unsanitary conditions. And a 72-hour ceasefire in Yemen hasn't held. Medea Benjamin is co-founder of the peace group Code Pink. Her latest book is Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection.
The question that the American people need to ask ourselves is, why is the U.S. participating in this Saudi-led bombing campaign that started 19 months ago? Yemen has a catastrophic situation where thousands of innocent people have died, millions of people have been displaced, and 80% of the population is dependent on humanitarian aid for their survival, but there is a blockade that is stopping food and medicines from coming in. Every day, there are children who are dying from malnutrition, and Yemen is facing a famine-like situation. In the meantime, many Yemenis look at this Saudi-led bombing as a U.S.-led bombing, because it's the United States that is providing the weapons, the training, the maintenance, refueling the planes in the air, the logistical support, the intelligence, and the diplomatic cover. A study done recently shows that one-third of the bombing targets have been civilian targets. They have attacked residential neighborhoods, schools, marketplaces, clinics, hospitals, weddings. And 2 weeks ago, a bombing of a funeral in the capital, Sana'a, where 1,000 people were attending, and the bombing left 142 dead and over 500 wounded. We have to question why the U.S. has been arming the Saudis for the last several decades, but particularly during the Obama administration. Saudi Arabia has become the number one weapons purchaser from the United States. The amounts of weapons are massive. Just in the last 8 years, $115 billion worth of weapons sold to this very repressive regime. Congress has unfortunately not questioned the administration, except for the most recent round of weapon sales, but we have not been able to get a majority of Congress people to say enough is enough. That's why we at Code Pink have launched a campaign asking people to call on their senators and their Congress people to say, the blood of the Yemeni people is on our hand. Stop arming the repressive Saudi regime. Cut off all weapon sales now.
Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink. Her latest book is Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. In other news, hundreds continue to block construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. They say the pipeline threatens water supplies and sacred sites. The pipeline is set to pass beneath the Missouri River upstream of Bismarck, the state capital. Helena Miel, also known to WBAI listeners as Earth Mom, is in North Dakota with the water protectors.
We are at the new camp, the treaty camp of 1851. We're on treaty territory, and we are right on the land where Dakota Access Pipeline is planned to go through. Matter of fact, one of the guys here, his teepee is right on land, and underneath it, it says DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline. The initials are there. And this is the last stand before the river, and we have heard that up in Bismarck there are tanks. There's police coming from all over, and they're in Bismarck, and they're not that far away. They're coming down, and they want to get everyone out of this new camp because it is totally in the way of construction. And the water protectors are here peacefully and prayerfully waiting in resistance to anyone taking us off this land. Earlier today, Jesse Jackson was with us. He did a media presentation, and then he came to the front line and he prayed with all of us, and he went down the line shaking everyone's hand. Last night, Mark Ruffalo was speaking to us at the casino because he came with some Navajo people and some solar people, and they are donating two mobile solar trucks to the camp that can also be used after this. I mean, the whole point is with Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline, it's one situation, but it's a really bigger situation. It's about all of Mother Earth, and it's about all of Mother Earth and all of us learning to live sustainably. It's more than just this one moment in time, however important this moment really is.
As we speak, people are cutting wood, trying to stay warm because they are getting frost and it's getting cold in the woods. There are about 200 people gathered with Helena. It was very hectic over the weekend, wasn't it?
Right, right. On Saturday, the water protectors went in to pray. And I've heard different numbers, but from legal, I heard 131 people were arrested. Then on Sunday, we went to the same spot, the spot where they put the dogs on everyone over Labor Day weekend, and the spot of the sacred burial ground. We stayed on the outside of it and we prayed. And then we came across the street, and that's when this new camp, the Treaty Camp of 1851, was started that day, because now this is really the stand here. And it started with one teepee, two teepees. Now there's probably about 15 teepees, and maybe about 50 or more tents. People are moving from the Ocheti Soconi camp to here in order just to stand tall. Right now I'm still at the Ocheti Soconi camp.
And so what are you expecting this evening?
We don't know. It's moment to moment. It's like at any time we'll get a call, everybody up to the front line, because there's talk that the police are coming. We've had like three false alarms already, and maybe they're staying back now because Jesse Jackson was here. Mark Ruffalo is probably at the other camp right now. I don't see him on the front line right now. I also saw that Susan Sarandon is here, but I can't tell you definitely about that. And obviously it's not about the celebrities, but if the celebrities bring notoriety and get this out to the forefront and into the public. But I will say, people I know at camp were driving to Bismarck for supplies. It's a family that's here. And they were interrogated, and the husband was driving, and the police went as far as asking the wife for her ID. And when people are arrested, they're not being read their rights. And when people are being arrested, they're being interrogated. They're being asked, why are you there? Have you been forced to be there? Is someone making you be there?
Any word over those who were arrested this weekend? What's become of them?
I think most are out. There's a good legal team. We all put the legal numbers. We take a magic marker and put them on our arms. One guy came out. I was talking to him, and they told him they were taking him 60 miles away. Turns out they're taking them as far as Fargo. They took them 180 miles away. It's crazy. It's really crazy. But everyone here is working together and helping each other. It's really a beautiful sight. And an interesting thing happened Sunday. One person got arrested. There are these little, I believe you call them ATVs. And it's not the police on them, where we set up the new camp, and someone was walking off in the hills, and this ATV came and grabbed one person and arrested them. They didn't get the second person because everybody teamed up and got around the second person. But it's wild stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what about the media coverage? Has there been much?
Well, from what I see, I don't have TV, and my internet, you know, is
no. In terms of in terms of people on the ground, are you seeing any television crews?
No. There's not. Okay. Not at all. Matter of fact, all the Bismarck papers do are lies. I mean, they shot a drone down that we had on Sunday. They shot it, which is illegal, and they were saying that we were using bows and arrows at them, and they were also saying that the drone was interfering. There's a drone right above me right now. The drone was interfering with their helicopter. I mean, the drone's 50 feet high. You know, it's really not interfering with their helicopter.
Whose drone?
They shot it.
Whose drone is that?
Our drone, ours, because we're taking photos and things. I mean,
see.
Everything is being documented, all the atrocities that they're doing against these people.
Gotcha. Okay, so please stay in touch, and we look forward to hearing from you tomorrow.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Helena Miel, also known to WBAI listeners as Earth Mum, is in North Dakota with the Water Protectors. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. This morning, 10 protesters chained themselves to the George Washington Bridge, causing a 90-minute delay for commuters, this during rush hour. Rebecca Miles has more.
Video footage from the protest shows the group unfurling a large banner which read, "Resist, Organized, Act Up." Drivers clashed with protesters in an effort to get the bridge open, ripping the banner from them, telling them to protest on their own time, as trunks honked in frustration. Police peeled off the protesters one by one as they arrested the group of 10. The group announced they were starting a new movement under the hashtag #WeAreVisible and are seeking to be part of the democratic process in the United States. Mahama Lopez of We Are Visible said as immigrants, they're tired of being in the shadows.
Immigrant workers and as an immigrant community, we are tired to be in the shadows. It's like as immigrants, we contribute in many different ways to this country, paying taxes, just basically consume and build in this country. But in order to be part of the taking decisions like the right to vote or, you know, at that level, but at local level, like example, I'm from Corona, Queens. If I want to be part of the taking decisions process, I'm not able because I don't have the citizenship. So how all these elections, which basically we believe is a fake democracy.
Lopez said if the U.S. was a real democracy, everyone who lived here would be able to vote, including the undocumented, resident aliens, and those with prior misdemeanors. The protest comes just 2 weeks before the election, and Lopez said both candidates are garbage. Lopez said Obama won the election because of support from immigrants and the black vote, with promises of immigration reform, and nothing happened except the Obama administration deported more immigrants in the entire history of the United States. Lopez says there's a big rally in Union Square Wednesday evening, and they're calling for a general strike on November the 7th, the day before the election. Basically, don't go to work, said Lopez. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
The New York City Council is urging every newly naturalized citizen to take advantage of an extended deadline through this Saturday to register to vote. Naturalized citizens are eligible to vote on November 8th, but you must register in person at the New York City Board of Elections by Saturday, October 29th.
Sexist, racist, xenophobe, if you're with him, you've got to go!
This afternoon, women with NOW, the National Organization for Women, gathered in front of Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue, calling for all candidates to declare whether they are for or against the GOP presidential nominee. Sonia Sanchez is president of NOW NYC.
So these New York elected officials and those running to represent you do not deserve the privilege to represent you if they are standing with Donald Trump. And they have had an opportunity, week after week, to rebuke him. They've had the opportunity every time he has said something disrespectful of women, when he has boasted about sexual assault, and they have yet to take a stand. And they will see the results at the polls.
Sanchez says the election is upsetting on so many levels.
It's What's most upsetting is the fact that it is a circus, and we have a candidate who is completely unprepared to be president, who has had a campaign filled with racism, sexism, and a complete lack of attention to the issues that are important to women and our families here.
Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman in the third and final debate between the two candidates, a comment which women say speaks more about him than her. Jean Beccaria is deputy director of Now NYC.
In record numbers, we are coming out and we are voting down misogyny, we are voting down sexism, we are voting down racism, and we will vote down also all the down-ballot candidates who continue to stand with him despite the ridiculous comments, the egregious comments, and the divisive rhetoric. That's what we're here to do.
And why are we nasty women?
We're nasty women because we speak out. We're nasty women because we stand up for ourselves. We're nasty women because we will not stand down. We're nasty women because we're going to come forward and tell our stories, because every single woman has experienced sexual harassment. Every single woman has had that feeling where they have felt abused or put down, where they had a gross person on the subway trying to rub up against them. This is our everyday lives, and we are not going to take it anymore. Enough.
Not from the president.
We are nasty. We will choose. Trump will lose.
We are nasty. We will choose. This November, Trump will lose. We are nasty. We will choose. This November, Trump will lose. We are nasty. We will choose. This November, Trump will lose. We are nasty. We will
And Beccaria calls out Trump for his unwillingness to accept the outcome of the election.
It's unbelievable, but in the last debate, Donald Trump actually said that he is not sure if he will concede the election if he loses on November 8th. Unprecedented in our history, a candidate saying that they will keep the American public in suspense. This is not a reality TV show. This is our presidential election. That is unacceptable. That's why we are out here today to show Donald Trump that this is what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like. Tell me what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tell me.
Jennifer Clark is an attorney with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, which has been investigating voter fraud. It found that most allegations of fraud turn out to be baseless.
It's a little hard to know exactly what he means when he says that the election is rigged, but we do know that he has been making a lot of statements about encouraging supporters to go down to the polling place and make sure that people aren't voting 10 times, 15 times. And he's, you know, there has been repeated discussions throughout the election season about the possibility of what really amounts to allegations of in-person impersonation fraud, with a voter either going to multiple places and trying to vote as a bunch of different people, or coming to the polling place and voting under 10 different names, 15 different names. And we have been studying exactly that kind of fraud for a decade, pretty much since 2007. And what we and others in the field have found is that kind of fraud is not a commonplace issue. It's not even close to being in the type of incident rates that could come close to rigging an election. We have a scholar who took a look at years and years and years of elections and found pretty much out of about a billion ballots cast, 31 possible credible instances of this type of fraud. So to say that is, the kind of rates of fraud that could rig an election or could sway an election is simply not supported by the evidence.
And finally, with Trump saying that the election is rigged, what he's really doing is impugning the electoral integrity of the system. Can you talk to this?
Yeah, you know, it is very upsetting, and, you know, it's hard to brush off as simple rhetoric and dirty politics, because there is, you know, our election system is really looked to by other countries around the world as an example of, you know, very well-run elections. And the idea that, you know, that doesn't mean that mistakes don't happen. And of course, these elections are all administered by humans, but if you, you know, reach out and work with and talk to local election officials, those who are actually charged with running the elections, you know, they're horrified at the idea, regardless of political party, they're horrified at the idea that, you know, this has become a part of the talk this campaign, because their entire job is working to make sure that people feel empowered to vote and that elections run as smoothly as possible. And that's why you have really seen secretaries of state, who tend to be the chief election official in various states, of all political stripes, come out against these comments. You know, Republican and Democratic Secretary of States alike have spoken out and said, this isn't true. You know, I oversee elections in my state, and they will not be rigged, and they are not rigged, and voters in my state should feel confident in the system. So really, there has those kinds of comments out of the election officials community.
But Trump keeps making those statements anyway.
Unfortunately, you know, This has been not a great campaign season for democracy issues, but you know, certainly we're hearing from all corners, people who study these issues and people who actually work in these issues on a day-to-day basis, that this is truly not something to be concerned about, and the voters should show up to the polls confident that their vote will count.
Right. So is this really an attempt to discourage voters from going to the polls?
It is.
It's suspicious.
If you look at the states where we have restrictive voting laws that have been placed on the books somewhat recently, states like North Carolina and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania before their voter ID law was struck down, and Texas, all of these places have, you know, recently passed a strict photo ID law. The politicians who supported that law in each one of those states, you know, are on record as in some form saying that they think it's going to make it harder for people who are going to vote against them to get out and vote. You know, you have the North Carolina legislature looking at who uses early voting, who uses same-day registration based on race, and then saying, well, we're going to make it harder for those people to vote because I don't think they're going to vote for me. We saw in Pennsylvania when they passed their photo ID law, politicians saying, oh, well, now the state is sewn up for, you know, Republican politicians saying now the state is sewn up for Mitt Romney. And in Wisconsin, you know, we had reports of legislators who supported the voter ID saying, you know, oh, this is going to be a boon for Republicans. You know, I don't know that any of that is true, but certainly the people who supported the law thought it was true, and that was part of the reason why they supported the law in the first place. So the idea that you would drum up fears about fraud in order to, manipulate the vote, suppress the vote in certain ways that you think will be politically advantageous to you would not be new. It wouldn't be the first time someone was doing that.
You know, that's really what I think the crux of it is that the laws were changed and they discourage minorities from going to the polls.
Right.
And also the lines in those places are in minority communities are very, very long.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it more difficult for them to go to the polls as well. They discourage the voters. So that's another thing that's been going on, and also less polling places in minority communities, I understand.
Yeah, we you know, the Brennan Center has studied long lines, and we've particularly looked at this overlay of sort of resource allocation, which includes both number of machines, number of polling sites, and also, you know, number of poll workers per capita, you know, per voter. And we have certainly seen in the counties that we have studied both the correlation between resource allocation and race, and also wait time and resource allocation and race. So those things are all working together. So yes, that's definitely true. You tend to see, at least in the places that we have studied, you tend to see a correlation between less resource allocation on election day and during early voting in minority polling sites. And you also see longer lines, which is certainly tied to having fewer resources devoted for, you know, voters to be to be processed through.
Even in upstate New York during the primary, the polling places were closed in the morning where workers could have gone to the polls, and they didn't open till noon.
Mm,
so this was
that.
Also discouraging. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. This was also discouraging. So just finally, what problems would you think that voters should look for this time as they cast their ballot?
So, you know, I think, of course, as I think I may have mentioned, there are voters in 14 states will be facing new restrictions for the first time in a presidential election when they go to vote this year. So, you know, certainly voters need to keep on top of what the requirements are in their state. And part of the problem is that we, you know, those have kind of been shifting and changing a lot recently. So one thing that we're worried about is sort of confusion and miseducation at the polls because, you know, states have been doing, in some cases, a less than stellar job of making sure that voters and poll workers have all of the up-to-date information in places like Texas and Wisconsin and North Carolina and other places where voting laws have recently been in flux because of litigation against restrictive laws.
So that's definitely something to watch.
Yeah, it, you know, certainly because, you know, it's been this summer we did see some victories in the courthouse. We saw pushback against Texas's strict photo ID law. We saw some pushback or some, you know, wiggle room in Wisconsin's strict photo ID law. And we saw a complete striking down of the omnibus restrictive voting law in North Carolina. But getting a win in the courthouse is really only the first step. What matters to voters is how that win is implemented and how much the state does to educate voters about their rights, to educate poll workers about what the processes should be on Election Day. If there's mistakes in that process, then it doesn't really matter what has happened at the courthouse because the end result is that voters are still disenfranchised through confusion, through misinformation, through poor public education. In addition to that, another issue that we should certainly look out for this election season, and which is part of kind of like a kind of the heated rhetoric that we were discussing around democracy this season, is concerns over, you know, voter intimidation at the polls. There have been a decent number of calls that we have seen both on a national and local level saying, you know, come and police the polls, come and look out to make sure that the right people are voting, things like that. And it's concerning because oftentimes that, you know, that can cross the line into intimidation and harassment. And almost every state has some kind of mechanism for poll watching because, of course, elections are supposed to be, you know, a public process. Voting itself is private, but the election should be held in a way that can be public and is held in that way, which is how we know that, you know, it's not rigged because it's a public act and checking in voters is a public act. And so many states have mechanisms for appointing poll watchers to... And it's often done in a bipartisan way. So you can have a poll watcher from one party that's appointed and a poll watcher from another party that's appointed. But, you know, they are required to follow certain requirements under state law. They're not allowed to harass with voters or interact with voters in an intimidating way. So, you know, those processes are in place. But what has been talked about more this season is sort of just a kind of ad hoc, you know, I send yourself to the polls as a self-appointed poll watcher, as, you know, your self-appointed policing of the poll station. And that's concerning because, you know, because too often that kind of self-policing of the polls can cross the line into intimidation and harassment of voters. And we've certainly seen that in the history of this country where that has been, you know, a sorry part of our voting history where voters, particularly minority voters, have been harassed by, you know, people at the polls who sort of self-appointed themselves as poll watchers. We definitely want to watch out for that. And in fact, this election season, for the first time in a presidential election in quite a while, there will be a reduced number of federal observers. The DOJ isn't usually in the process of sending what are called federal observers to watch elections in places where there is a chance that, you know, that kind of intimidation might happen. As a result of the Shelby County decision in 2013, the DOJ has cut back extensively on its federal observer program. And so there are far fewer federal nonpartisan official election observers who are being sent out to polling places of concern this year compared to, you know, any recent presidential election. So, you know, that there is a cause for concern there.
There's also concern about some of the Senate races, which are so close, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Pennsylvania. These are very close races, and I would assume that that one would be watchful over any intimidation of voters in those states.
Yeah, certainly. You know, if there is a particularly heated race, that is even more cause for concern. And like I said, I think we have seen a lot of calls, both at the local level like that and just sort of generally at the national level, that has been more a part of the discussion this year than it has been in recent presidential campaigns. So it's certainly something that election officials are aware of and are looking out for because, you know, it is, again, in their interest to keep order at the polling place. But voters should certainly, you know, look out for themselves, make sure that they understand their rights if someone does attempt to, you know, persuade them or harass them about voting a certain way, things like that. And voters should be aware that there are protections out there against that. They should certainly know the number to call, which is 888-R-VOTE. That's a nonpartisan election protection hotline that will help assist voters if they run into any problems with intimidation or if they have questions about what the law actually is in their state because there have been so many changes recently. You know, they should certainly give election protection a call at 888-R-VOTE.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Clark is an attorney with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, October 26, 2016. The news was produced with Daniel Johnson, Helena Miel, Rebecca Miles, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York. And this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.